From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. We begin this hour with Pakistan, where officials are trying to stop the biggest lake from bursting. Record floods have killed more than 1,300 people. Millions have fled their homes, and now there's concern over hunger and disease. Masood Khan is Pakistan's ambassador to Washington, and he joins us on Zoom. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Can I ask you about Manchar Lake, which is at risk of bursting? Over the weekend, officials released some water into nearby villages after warning people to evacuate. I understand the water is still high. What options does the government have now?
Well, very limited. As a matter of fact, what we're trying to do is to shore up its embankments and gut it from some places so that the water can flow into the Indus River. And this is a disaster, a new disaster, which has developed in the larger disaster. And villages have been inundated and townships have been swept away. So we're trying to do our best to cope with the situation.
And just to kind of back up and understand, this year's summer monsoon season has brought far too much rain. Is it clear, you know, how much this is natural variation and how much this is attributed to climate change?
Well, it is direct impact of climate change, and scientists have established that. I was reading these articles from such magazines as Nature and others who specialize in scientific matters. What they have established is that there was this unusual, unprecedented pattern. We witnessed forest fires, then there were heat waves, and then, of course, there was glacier melt, and then there were monsoon rains. And the result is unprecedented floods in the history of Pakistan. So it has a direct linkage with climate change. And the people of Pakistan are feeling very, very bad because, I mean, their contribution to greenhouse gas emissions is less than 1%, 0.4%. And they are the eighth most vulnerable country in the world. And now we are paying the price of climate change.
I understand about half of the country's food supply comes from Sindh province, which has been severely impacted. What is the food supply situation now, and what is the fear or the reality of waterborne diseases?
Well, food supply situation is very dire. We were facing the crunch before the floods because of the Ukraine war, and Pakistan was facing food insecurity and food inflation. But this has been exacerbated by these floods. Major priority is to rush food to these relief camps. I mean, the bulk of the farmland has been destroyed, and this is compounding food insecurity in Pakistan. And that's why we need international assistance. And you'd asked about waterborne diseases.
Oh, yes.
What we're seeing is an outbreak of cholera, diarrhea, dengue fever, and malaria. And since most of the hospitals have been destroyed or they have been inundated, we have a medical emergency. Some 75,000 women are pregnant, and some of them are about to deliver. So, I mean, the conditions are really bad.
There is, of course, this appeal to the international community. There is a broader question or discussion of climate change and the responsibility of the industrial countries. But can I ask you about governance in Pakistan? Some analysts make the argument that the country could have had a broader flood plan, could have managed better reservoirs that are choked with silt, and managing canals to divert water away from the Indus River. Is there more longer-term planning and preparation that needs to happen?
Yes, the resilience. Let me tell you that we had two major natural disasters. One was the 2005 earthquake, and then there was the 2010 flood. With the help of the international community, we responded to these catastrophes, and we tried to build preparedness and response infrastructure and system. And that has worked very well up to now. Although our system was not perfect, we were able to warn people about the coming floods, and we were able to save many lives. But when you look at the enormity of these floods, we were not prepared. Nobody could have been prepared. I think that even if this flood had hit some of the most developed countries, they would have had difficulty in responding to it effectively. So, yes, we must learn lessons and we should prepare better for the future, because one thing is established, that Pakistan is prone to national disasters, and therefore we should have a better system. And there I would appeal to the international community and governments in general and the United Nations system itself, that they should come forward and help us build resilience in Pakistan for dealing with disasters.
Masood Khan is Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S. We've been speaking to him about the devastating flooding in Pakistan. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for your time, and we send our best to you and your country.
Thank you so much. It has been a pleasure talking to you.
To Colorado now, where wheat farmers are worried about this year's harvest, and not just because of the drought. There's a small, pesky bug that has proven to be incredibly destructive to their crop. KUNC's Ray Solomon explains.
One glance around the Northrop dining room will clue you into the family business. The table centerpiece? A vase of wheat stems. And the china set on the shelf has a wheat stalk pattern, a family heirloom.
They were my great-grandmas, so at least three generations.
Wow.
So.
Nate Northrop is now the fourth generation growing winter wheat on about 3,000 dry acres in the rural North Colorado town of New Raymer. Dryland farming has never been easy. But since 2010, Northrop's been facing a challenge that would have baffled his predecessors, the wheat stem sawfly. It's a pest that topples stems of wheat at the base, flattening fields, usually just before the harvest.
Yeah, it used to be just a few swaths around the edges, pretty bad, and then the next year following, it would just be entire fields, like just laying on the ground. I mean, it's devastating.
But a field leveled by sawfly also devastates the next year's harvest. For dryland farmers like Northrop, what's almost as important as the wheat crop itself is the crop residue. That's the stubble left over after the harvest. Residue prevents soil erosion, a major concern on these windswept plains. It also keeps the snow settled in place during the winter, locking in precious moisture.
Out here with limited rainfall, the wheat residue is really vital.
Last year, sawfly infested nearly 1 million acres of the state's eastern plains, causing more than $31 million in damage. That's according to a study by the Colorado Association of Wheat Growers and Colorado State University. Numbers from this year's harvest are still trickling in, but with wheat prices surging, losses are expected to hover around $41 million, all thanks to the wheat stem sawfly.
Contrary to the name, it's not a fly, it's actually a wasp.
Dr. Erica Pierce studies wheat stem sawfly as a postdoctoral researcher at Colorado State University. She says the pest isn't new to Colorado, and it wasn't always a pest. It's been at home on the Eastern Plains since long before Nate Northrop's great-grandfather ever picked up a hoe.
It was initially discovered in non-cultivated grasses, so the grasses on the side of the road, in 1874 in Colorado. It only became a pest of winter wheat in Colorado in 2010.
That's because of a change in the sawfly life cycle. The insect started emerging earlier and earlier in the spring until eventually the sawfly synced up with winter wheat.
The only way that we can solve this problem right now is new varieties that are resistant.
Esten Mason is lead wheat breeder at Colorado State University. He says pesticides don't work on sawfly. The best defense is better wheat genetics, specifically better stems. Traditional wheat stems are hollow, like a straw. Mason and his team have been developing new strains with solid and semi-solid stems that are stronger and denser. Instead of a flimsy drinking straw, think a sturdy lollipop stick.
The sawfly can still lay an egg in there, but that developing larva kind of suffocates and just dies, basically.
The downside to the new varieties is that more material in the stem means less material for the grain. The solid stem varieties can't match the yield of traditional wheat. But Mason says at the end of the season, at least the wheat will be standing instead of falling over. And that makes all the difference to Nate Northrup. After years of increasing sawfly damage, he started experimenting with solid stem varieties a few years ago, like this field of feathery golden wheat bobbing in the wind. He says it looks encouraging, but still expects a lackluster yield.
We've had phenomenal years, and we've had pretty bleak, pretty tough years. I guess you take the good with the bad, and the bad years make you appreciate the good.
Northrup knows it won't be a phenomenal year for the crop, but with the solid stem wheat, things are looking good for a strong crop residue when the harvest wraps up. That means he'll have a shot at a better season next year. For Here and Now, I'm Ray Solomon.
The idea of reconstruction suggests rebuilding, rebirth. Our next guest, historian Peniel Joseph, counts three periods of reconstruction in American history. First, the post-Civil War period. Second, the Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and 60s. And the third is what we are in right now. Peniel Joseph is professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. And his new book is The Third Reconstruction: America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century. Peniel Joseph, welcome back to Here and Now.
Great to be here.
In your book, you mentioned history as an indispensable tool to understand where we are today. So first, if I can ask you to connect some of what we've seen recently to this historical framing you present in your book. As you watched the mob storm the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and the white supremacist march in Charlottesville that turned violent in August 2017, do you connect that to what you describe as the first Reconstruction?
Absolutely. In a lot of ways, what we've seen, especially during the period since Barack Obama's election, the period that I call the Third Reconstruction, we've seen a lot of comparisons to the 1950s and 60s, and I certainly understand that in the Civil Rights period. Mm-hmm. But really, the more accurate description is to look at the first period of Reconstruction, which is really the three decades after the end of slavery and the Civil War in 1865. And during that time period, you see two emerging sentiments in American history. You see supporters of multiracial democracy that we might call Reconstructionist, and you see advocates of white supremacy that we might call Redemptionist. And those two are quarreling or battling or confronting each other during those three decades. And the times where Reconstructionists have the upper hand, you see Black elected officials, you see Black voting rights, Black people owning land and building schools and churches. And when Redemptionists have the upper hand, you really see a lot of political violence, the rise of the Klan, and policies, Black codes, grandfather clauses, convict lease systems, sharecropping, peonage, that really degrade Black citizenship and dignity. So when we think about Charlottesville in 2017 and January 6th, we have to go back to that first period of Reconstruction to see that those sort of unhappy patterns are rooted in that second American founding during the period of Reconstruction.
Well, and in this backlash, you write a lot about this lost cause framing as part of the Jim Crow era. And that, to many, shows up in the statues in Charlottesville that were at the center of that violence in the first place.
Absolutely. So there are these narrative wars that come out of Reconstruction. And the narrative wars go something like this. One side, who are the Reconstructionists, really want to talk about the emancipationist legacy of the Civil War, that we are now a multiracial democracy. Everyone should have the right to vote. Everyone should have access to citizenship and dignity. The other side, really, which is the Redemptionist side, has this idea of the lost cause, this idea that the South was this honorable nation that fought back against a federal government that was encroaching on their individual rights and freedom. And that side really wins the peace. So the South loses the war, but wins the peace. And when we think about Gone with the Wind, Birth of the Nation, which is a 1915 silent movie where you have white actors in blackface, acting as if all Black soldiers were raping white women and the Klan are heroes. Those are narrative wars that way before you get to constructions like critical race theory and efforts to suppress the teaching of Black history or racial injustice or the Holocaust, you've got this cultural war against the emancipationist legacy of the Civil War. And what's interesting about that story is that that story influences public policy and justifies lynching, it justifies racial segregation, it justifies separate and unequal schools. So stories matter.
Yeah, and boy, your phrase, narrative wars, captures this tension so well. That keeps coming back in history. And I want to ask you to talk about this second Reconstruction period you lay out in your book. That, of course, begins with the 1954 Supreme Court ruling, Brown versus Board of Education, and the civil rights movement of that period. Let's play a little bit of audio from President John F. Kennedy giving a televised speech in June of 1963.
100 years of delay have passed since President Lincoln freed the slaves, yet their heirs, their grandsons, are not fully free. They are not yet freed from the bonds of injustice. They are not yet freed from social and economic oppression. And this nation, for all its hopes and all its boasts, will not be fully free until all its citizens are free.
So in this period, what is the hope of the Reconstructionists, as you describe, and what is the backlash?
Well, the hope is really to fulfill the promise of the first Reconstruction. And that's why you get the focus on ending racial segregation and winning voting rights. What's really remarkable about the second Reconstruction is that we really finally achieve a racial justice consensus that lasts for 50 years between the 1963 John F. Kennedy speech and the Shelby v. Holder 2013 Supreme Court decision that really rolls back the most important parts of the Voting Rights Act. And that 50-year period, that's how we get Barack Obama, that's how we get Hillary Clinton, that's how we get Stacey Abrams. And really, we are living in this post-racial consensus period. That's what's so interesting about this third Reconstruction. It starts with Barack Obama and this sort of period of thinking Reconstructionists have won in perpetuity. We see the next beat is the rise of Black Lives Matter in the aftermath of Trayvon Martin. And then the next beat is going to be MAGA, Trump, and then finally what happened in 2020 all the way to the January 6th insurrection.
You mentioned President Obama and Trayvon Martin. Here is Obama speaking in 2012.
When Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here, I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that that doesn't go away.
You know, for so many of us, President Obama elevated this historical question, this historical conversation, as he mentioned in the sound we just heard. And yet, in your book, you seem to have a mixed tone about how President Obama fits into this history.
I think that Obama embodies Black citizenship from above. It takes the Black Lives Matter protest in Ferguson to have him be able to recognize what Black dignity from below looks like. And those are the folks who are incarcerated, who are impoverished, who haven't had the opportunities and the outcomes that the first family, the first Black family did. Obama and BLM eventually get to work together somewhat in creative tension, but it really takes the rise of MAGA and Trump and the existential threat to democracy for Obama by 2020 to admit what we'd all seen before our eyes, that the country was crumbling, that race was at the center of this, and even the first Black president and even the multiracial supporters of democracy weren't enough to withstand the rising tide of white supremacy that really resembled the same rising tide of white supremacy 150 years earlier.
Finally, Professor Joseph, this history and recent events you write about is so dark. There is so much loss. There is so much death. And yet at the end, the last three words in your book are, "I choose hope." Can you explain that?
Well, certainly throughout the book, I talk about especially Black women like Ida B. Wells, Angela Davis, but then contemporaries Tamika Mallory, Opal Tometi, Alicia Garza, Stacey Abrams, Kamala Harris, who have been fighting for citizenship and dignity and trying to tell us a different story, a newer story about ourselves. And I think I always find hope in the way in which you have so many Black people alongside of white people and Latinx and Asian and Indigenous people in solidarity with each other who want to bring about that multiracial democracy that Reconstructionists imagined in the 19th century. And then finally, my mother, who's my biggest teacher, my 83-year-old mother, gives me hope because she, you know, hoped against all odds to raise me and my older brother in an unforgiving New York City in the 1980s. And we survived, and in ways we thrived. So I still absolutely choose hope. And I think that, like the activist Maryam Kaba says, hope is a discipline. Hope is something that we have to practice every day. And it's preceded by action.
Peniel Joseph is a professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century. Professor Joseph, thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott. I enjoyed the conversation.
And you can read an excerpt of his book at hereandnow.org.
The disputed presidential election in Kenya is now officially over. The country's Chief Justice, Martha Koome, made the announcement yesterday.
We are of the view that the pointed irregularities and irregularities were not of such magnitude as to affect the final result of the presidential election.
That election was held on August 9th, but the final result had been held up for nearly a month after the losing candidate, Raila Odinga, claimed the vote was rigged. Deputy President William Ruto now has a clear path to becoming the country's next leader. Abdi Latif Dahir is the New York Times East Africa correspondent. He joins us now from Nairobi. And Abdi, did the Kenyan Supreme Court find any evidence to support Odinga's claims that the election was rigged?
No, actually, they didn't. They did look into 9 determinations in the petition that was filed by Raila Odinga, and they rejected all of them. They rejected accusations that the vote had been rigged, that the ballots had been stuffed, or even that the election technology system had been hacked and the results falsified. One other interesting thing about the ruling yesterday was that it was unanimous, but it was also interesting to hear the use of very strong language. They described the accusation as sensationalism, as hot air, and they said that they amounted to a wild goose chase that yielded nothing of value.
Odinga has a history of this. He's run for president 5 times now and unsuccessfully challenged the result of the last election for the same reason. What's his reputation at this point in Kenya?
That's a good question. I mean, there's going to be a lot of soul searching to do over the coming days. Of course, he did come out yesterday saying that he respects the court's decision, but, quote, vehemently disagrees with it. One of the things about this election was that it was seen largely as the closest chance that he had to the presidency, particularly after he made a pact with the outgoing president, Uhuru Kenyatta, in 2018. But because both of them were the sons of the country's founding fathers, their deal was seen as an elite pact, and an Odinga presidency was largely viewed as a continuation of a Kenyatta presidency or a continuation of dynastic rule in Kenya. And so Ruto, in many ways, came out against that, even though he's very wealthy businessman, he's a country's vice president. He came out to cast himself as the opposite candidate, issuing a clarion call to the young, ambitious, hardworking Kenyans who are trying to make ends meet, and basically saying that just like you, you know, who are poor, I was once poor, I went to school without shoes for a very long time, and if you elect me as president, you know, I would be able to work on your behalf and solve your problems.
Well, the election was very close, and Kenya is a key democracy in Africa. So after this disputed election is the sense there that the integrity of the election system of the country, that it has been upheld.
Kenya is the largest economy in the region. It's a major ally of the West in the fight against terrorism. A lot of people look at it, particularly if you look at the East Africa region, it's a stable democracy in a region torn by civil war, strife, you know, led by autocrats. And so the decision from the court yesterday and before that, you know, the announcement by the Electoral Commission in many ways are being seen as reflecting the fidelity, the transparency, and the strength of the Kenyan institutions.
The New York Times East Africa correspondent Abdi Latif Dahir speaking to us from Nairobi. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Today is the first day of school in Uvalde, Texas, where that mass shooting at Robb Elementary killed 19 students and two teachers. Students who attended Robb Elementary during the shooting are at different schools in the district, and at each of their desks, a gift was waiting for them today, a stuffed animal, paid for by a GoFundMe campaign organized by Ella Klimowitz of Oxford, Michigan. She survived a shooting at her own high school last fall. And Ella joins us, as does her mother, Carrie. Ella, welcome.
Hello.
So you raised something on the order of $24,000 for 1,100 stuffed animals, stuffed wildcats, which I understand that's your school mascot, these wildcats, and you delivered them to Uvalde students and teachers last week. How did that go? Tell me a story.
It went really well. It was super busy. We weren't there very long. We started off by going into two different buildings, and we brought all the stuffed animals and put them on every single kid's desk, along with a handmade card from Oxford. Some of the teachers were there prepping their classroom, so we were able to talk with them and exchange stories. And it was really hard, but I think a lot of them appreciated another community kind of having the same story and comparing like what happened to them and what happened to us. And sometimes it's good to talk about that stuff with people that understand.
Yeah. And were you 17 or 18 when the mass shooter came to Oxford High School? You were a senior in high school, yeah?
Yes, I was 17 when the shooter came to my school.
Okay. And these kids in Uvalde starting today, I mean, they're about 10 or so. I mean, if you interact with these students in the future, how do you think about communicating this grief to younger kids?
I mean, obviously it's way harder, and I can't imagine being so young and that like innocence being taken away from you. So yeah. I think it's good for them to talk to people about it. And I think they look up to kids like me that are like a little bit older than them and not like super adults, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Why is it good to talk about it? I understand you've talked to many people, including a couple of therapists. Do I have that right?
Yes. Yep. I think it's good to talk about it because a couple months after the shooting happened at our school, I kind of didn't remember what exactly happened because there was so much going on. But talking to people kind of like brought out what I remembered. And it kind of gave me, like, not closure, but, like, it was easier for me to process.
Yeah. When you first heard about Uvalde, what went through your mind?
Yeah, I was just sitting in my bed, and I remember seeing it on the TV, and it was, like, reliving it. And I was really angry because I didn't think it would happen this soon after it happened to our school. Like, unfortunately, knew that it'd probably happen again somewhere, but I didn't think it would be this soon and at an elementary school.
Yeah. And so you move forward, raised all this money for these gifts for each student in Uvalde. Describe for me, for us, the wildcat in question. What does it look like?
It looks like a mini wildcat. It's super soft. It's like, it has a white t-shirt on it that says Oxford Hearts You. And it's in our Oxford spirit colors of blue and gold.
Oh, that's nice. You also left cards for the students. Do you have one on you? Can you read one to us?
I don't have one on me, but I can remember what most of them said.
Yeah, if you can paraphrase, that'd be great.
A lot of them on the front of the card said things like, Oxford loves you, you're strong, you're appreciated, you're brave. And then some of them also had phone numbers in case some of the little kids wanted to contact a student from Oxford.
Oh, nice. You know, on a day like today, I cannot imagine what it's like for these Uvalde students to go back to school. What was it like for you when you had to go back to school?
It was unimaginably very, very hard. Every single day I would, my goal would be to just stay in the building. If that's in a counseling office, a therapy room, it didn't matter. If I was in the building, I was proud of myself at the end of the day.
Mm. You know, we like to say or assume that an event like this changes a person forever. Is that true?
Yeah, I think a sense of innocence was definitely taken away from me. And I think it did change me for the worse and for the better. I mean, I'm always triggered by a lot of things like noises or screaming or ambulances, stuff like that. So there's always probably forever going to be triggers for me in my life. But it also made me more mature and made me want to take initiative too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Ella, thank you very much. And, you know, best of luck to you and your class for, having the courage to move forward, and for you in particular for raising all this money to do this.
Yes.
Well done.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And pass the phone to your mom, please.
All right. Hello.
Hello. Hi, Carrie. It's Scott Tong at Here and Now. It's so good to hear from Ella and her thoughts. Mm-hmm. Having experienced that as a parent, how do you think the parents in Uvalde are feeling right now?
I would assume, based on what we went through, that they would probably have a lot of anxiety. And just being away from their kids, I know at first for us, just to be away from our kids if they went out with friends or anything like that was hard for parents. We just wanted to keep them in a bubble with our family.
And how is it now? I mean, it's around 10 months on, from the mass shooting?
Yeah, it's definitely better. Time does make it a little easier. Although we just also started our school year and the anniversary is coming up. We just had our first football game, and we lost one of our football players. And so we had tributes to the kids that were victims at our shooting. So a lot of it is coming back up, during the summertime, lots of healing and things. So it's kind of a tricky time starting the school year for the community of Oxford, for the kids, for the students, for the staff. So it's better, but still difficult right now.
Yeah. And Carrie, what have you learned about being a parent, going through an experience you never want to go through? What have you learned about rebuilding trust in the system, rebuilding trust in society?
I mean, I think we're still learning every day. I guess, a lot of us kind of realized not to sort of sweat the small stuff when you have something like this happening. You kind of rethink okay, here's the big things in my kids' lives, and here's what's important. Are they safe? Are they happy? Are they healthy? Rather than do they have, good grades or, things like that maybe you thought about more before. And, also we're all just maneuvering it too. The families and the parents and the staff, everybody, nobody expected this, and nobody quite knows how they're going to get through it and make sure that their kids are okay. So we're kind of just muddling through it and trying to rely on resources like therapy and things like that to help with it.
Yeah. And finally, your thoughts on your daughter, Ella. I mean, what a gesture, raising all this money and traveling with you, I believe, down to Uvalde to deliver a wildcat, a stuffed wildcat mascot to every student there.
Yeah, we're really, really proud of her. And she really worked very hard for this. You know, this summer was supposed to be the summer before she starts college and,
yeah,
you know, all kinds of fun stuff. And she really devoted a lot of her summer to organizing this. And her dad and I are really proud of her.
Well, you should be. We have been talking to Carrie Klimowitz. She is the mother of Ella Klimowitz, who was a survivor of last year's school shooting in Oxford, Michigan. And they just returned from Uvalde, Texas, where they donated stuffed animals to the children and staff at Robb Elementary School. Carrie, thanks for taking the time.
Of course. Thank you.
Most city parks are inviting spaces where people go to get some fresh air or a quick reset. But climate change is threatening cities, including the urban spaces that help us cope with the heat. NPR's Rebecca Hersher has this story about how cities are fighting back.
Grab one of these little leaves and then...
Claire Miller is a park ranger in Phoenix. And if park ranger makes you think like Yosemite or the Grand Canyon, think smaller. Claire works for the municipal government, and she does her park rangering in city parks.
So there's the sewer. You can kind of see it.
Oh, yeah. That's a gigantic cactus.
You
oh
see all the sticks in there?
Yeah.
Looks like just a pile of sticks. That's the great horned owl's nest.
I met her in a city park in northern Phoenix on a hot morning in July. It was almost 100 degrees. The park begins in a neighborhood with rows of single-story houses, and a steep trail runs up into what looks like barren desert. But it's not barren.
Yeah, now I'm looking down here. See that just pile, looks like pile of sticks and cactus, pieces of cactus trimmings. That's actually a pack rat nest. That's an animal's home.
Claire's life's work, this is her 35th year working in the parks here, is to make nature accessible to the people of Phoenix. The city has hundreds of acres of parkland, including miles and miles of trails. But in the summer, Claire's job gets harder because it gets so hot so frequently that it can be dangerous to hike. And she says people don't realize that they're in danger.
They're like, well, how hard can it be? It's only a mile, and it's in the middle of the city. It's like, well, it's a mile straight up on nothing but rocks. So we always joke about it as being a hot pizza oven because, I mean, that sun, it just radiates, and that heat coming off of things is just brutal. And so they think, oh, it can't be that bad.
Like it's right here in the middle of Phoenix.
Exactly. But it is that bad.
Extreme heat is one of the many ways that climate change is putting stress on city parks, keeping people from enjoying them on one hand, and also threatening the plants and animals that live there and aren't necessarily built for a changing climate. The question for city governments across the country is, how can we protect urban parks and help them adapt to a hotter earth? And on the other side of the country, in New York City, that question is top of mind for caretakers in Manhattan's Central Park. Michelle Mueller-Gamez is the director of climate change research with the Central Park Conservancy. She and I met on a warm, sunny day in a very cool and shady part of the park.
Yeah, I definitely think about, like, we want parks to be seen as part of the climate change solution.
She says city parks are threatened by climate change, yes, but they also help. The trees and other plants absorb carbon dioxide. Green spaces soak up excess water to protect nearby roads and houses from flooding.
We also know that the park itself can cool the adjacent neighborhoods. So this is why equity is really important, where parks are placed and how they're managed, so that they are cooling neighborhoods equitably.
But Gamez says there's a lot we don't know about how to manage city parks in a hotter world. Like, if native trees in a park are replaced by non-native trees, does that change the park's cooling effects? What if you replace some trees with a soccer field or build a new swimming pool? To answer those questions, Gamez and her colleagues are working with scientists at the newly launched Central Park Climate Lab. The goal is to do research that's helpful not just in New York, but across the country, including in cities like Phoenix, where the city government is grappling with some serious heat-related problems in parks. PJ Dean is with the local firefighters union. He explains that the fire department has always been responsible for rescuing people who get hurt or sick when they're hiking in city parks.
Obviously, in Phoenix, heat's nothing new for us, and it's something we've always been able to manage relatively well.
But the number of heat-related emergencies has skyrocketed. Even a twisted ankle can be life-threatening if the person is deep in a desert park, exposed to the blazing sun. Last year, there were back-to-back calls to 911 from hikers in city parks who needed to be rescued on a 115-degree day. And Dean says two of the rescuers ended up in the hospital with heat-related illness.
And I mean, these are triathletes. These are people who are in phenomenal shape, who are very familiar with this work. And that was our wake-up call.
After that, the union asked the city to close parks on the hottest days to protect hikers and first responders. Now, some of the most popular trails are closed on days when there's an excessive heat warning, but they stay open later into the evening to encourage people to get outside when it's less hot. It's an example of how cities are looking for solutions to make sure parks are a place where people can recharge, even as the climate warms. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.